A production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
House State Affairs Committee will please now come to order. I'd like to welcome the overflow crowd that's joined us here today, and as well as all the folks listening to us live on the internet. And we would like to also remind everyone now is the ideal time to check your cell phones, put them on the off or vibrate position, and ask if you're going to testify today that you please register at the podium in the back. Lobbyists will ask you to have your badge on if you come to testify on behalf of anyone. With that, we would ask the Secretary to please call the roll.
Representatives Boomgarten.
Here.
Ingalls.
Here.
Feinstein. Gosch.
Here.
Hunhoff. Lucas.
Here.
Lust.
Here.
Rausch.
Here.
Rave.
Here.
Steele.
Here.
Turberville. Gnome.
Here.
Fain.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
With that, is there a motion for approval of the minutes of the previous meeting?
Second.
Motion by Rausch, second by Rave to approve the minutes. Any comments? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. With that, Senator Hance, I hope you indulge us for just a couple of minutes. The fellow right in front of you has asked us to move his quick little bill up to the top, so we'd like to do that so we can move him on out. We'll be moving Senate Bill 180 to the top of today's calendar and then taking everything after that in the order in which it's listed. So with that, are there any proponents for Senate Bill 180 to revise certain provisions concerning statements submitted by organizations making contributions to ballot question committees? Proponents for Senate Bill 180, good morning, Senator Valley.
Mike, will you turn your mic on? Is that the story there? Again, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the State Affairs Committee. It's good to come back over to the House. I enjoy this. This bill started during the election, and I had Secretary of State Nelson come down to the Lions Club to explain the ballot measures. And if you've never done that when you have ballot measures, I just really encourage you to do that. He does a very good job. He's very fair to both sides, and so I would suggest you do that. But we were talking about this before the meeting, and I was asking him on the Yes on 10, I says, well, where are these folks getting their money? He says, well, a large part of it we don't know. I says, well, who's sending it? Can't we figure this out? And the discussion went on like that, and I says, well, don't they have to sign a document that says that they didn't give this money to influence a ballot measure? They just say that? And he says, well, yeah. I says, let's see if we can't find a law to or a bill that would change that. So Senate Bill 180 is a bill to help provide more transparency in our ballot question financing and reporting laws. It merely puts teeth into the current law. Okay, it doesn't change a contribution amount or who can or cannot give to a ballot question committee, nor who does or who does not have to file a ballot question committee report. When an organization that is not a ballot question committee contributes over $10,000 to a ballot question committee under this bill, it will now have to also provide a statement signed under oath that it was not organized for, nor did it raise money for the purpose of influencing the ballot question. If they truthfully are not able to sign such a statement, then by current law, they are a ballot question committee and have to file a report as a ballot question committee. The difference is you must now sign a document under oath that the money was not raised to influence that ballot question. That's what this bill does. And if you do not sign such a statement, or if you do sign such a statement and it is later found to be false, it's perjury, a class 6 felony. So if you make an error anywhere else in your document, we all fill those out. If you put something in the wrong column or whatever, that's still a class 1 misdemeanor. These folks will know when they sign that document if they raise that money for the ballot question committee or not. The purpose is to make sure that all South Dakotans know who is trying to influence the the laws by which we all must live. Summary, this does not change who can or cannot give money to a ballot committee. It does not change the amount you can give. It does not change who either has or does not have to file a report. So it does not change any requirements. It just makes you sign under oath that you meet those requirements. Now, if you have specific technical questions regarding ballot question committee rules and the law, the Secretary of State is here, and he can probably tell you a lot better about those than I can. But I will stand by for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Further proponents? Morning, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chris Nelson, Secretary of State, and I certainly rise to support this bill. If I could just reemphasize Senator Valley's closing points, this does not change who does and does not have to file as a ballot question committee, does not change who can give money, does not change the amounts that are reported. It's simply a mechanism for making those organizations that may in fact need to report and aren't currently fully aware that they need to. One of the other things, as you look at this four-page bill, you're going to see an awful lot of overstrike and underscore. And the reason for that is on the Senate side, there were several senators that thought the existing statute ought to be completely rewritten. And they took the opportunity to do that. The substantive change in this bill is on page 3, lines 19 and 20, where it's asking that if, in fact, you're an organization, in other words, a corporation, a nonprofit, an association, Lions Club, and you give more than $10,000, then along with that contribution, you've got to give a statement saying you didn't raise this from some other source or collect it from some other source, but rather it's part of your treasury funds. The last point I'd like to make is because it's dealing with those contributions over $10,000, the number of these statements that are going to have to be filled out and passed on are going to be very, very minimal. We don't have that many large contributions, but if you're playing at that level, we think this is going to be a good addition to our campaign finance laws. Be happy to answer questions when appropriate.
Thank you, sir. Further proponents? Are there any further proponents to Senate Bill 180? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Any opponents to Senate Bill 180? Seeing none, we'll waive rebuttal and move to committee questions. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Rave.
Senator Valley. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
It's early and maybe I'm just not catching it, but if someone is giving that sum of money, I'm wondering, aren't they trying to influence the, I mean, obviously they're giving money to either one side or the other. Aren't they, by the very nature of giving the money, trying to influence? I mean, I like the bill, and I'll probably support it. I'm just questioning, isn't that the whole point of giving the money? So you influence the election in the favor of the side you gave the money to?
Very good question. And it's what we're trying to do is if you raise the money to influence. Not if you gave the money to it. You can give the money to influence. That's not a problem. If I am the Lions Club would never do this, but let's use that. And they have a big treasury, and they decide to, there's a bill up or a ballot question up, and they decide in their meeting, you know, let's give $12,000 to this. Well, they had never gone out and raised that money. They'd done it through pancake feeds or whatever, and they had never raised the money for that ballot question, okay? But they decided to give it. Now let's say you're the Lions Club, and you say, well, we have $1,000 here, and let's go out and raise another $11,000 to do this. That's when you've crossed the line because now you've gone out and raised money to influence the question.
Okay.
So it's whether it's how you raise the money that's the pertinent to the question, as I understand.
Perfect. Thank you.
Representative Noem.
Senator Valley, how would you enforce that?
The enforcement is somewhat difficult. Some of those committees do have to have audits, or they do have to have some disclosure, and so it may be found out at a later point in time. The point is the person that the president and secretary of that group, they have to get out their pen and sign this document that says, under penalty of perjury, I'm signing that we did not raise this money to influence that ballot question. Now, if they're later found out to have not been truthful, and it is perjury, it isn't a class one misdemeanor. It's a felony. And so if you are in the practice of law, if you are, you know, want to get a job in a bank, want to get a bond, all that is going to make your life extremely difficult. So what the part of the enforcement is just knowing that you are now committing a felony, and this could be quite detrimental if it is later found out.
Senator Valley, back to Representative Rave's question. I read in here, and there's a number of points where it says contribute, and you're talking about raising. Is it your opinion, or the Secretary states that on page 3, line 19, that would, is that the intention of that, is to clear up raise, not contribute, or do we need to make it clearer in the bill? Are you comfortable with that?
Yeah, it says no part of the contribution was raised or collected by the organization for the purpose of influencing the ballot question. So it's if you are raising to influence that, if you just have it in your association's treasury stock and you decide to give it, well, that's fine. We're just saying if you're going out and trying to raise money to do this, then
so
that's a different question.
And then you
have to file this. And that's current law.
Okay.
We're just making it so now that if you do that, you have to sign a document that says you did that, and it's perjury if you were not truthful.
Any other
just
questions?
Just trying to put some teeth in.
Good. Any further questions, Representative Hanoff?
Mr. Chairman. Secretary Nelson, I think I like the tightening of the law. I'm just trying to get my head around how it would actually work. And can you give me, are there any real-life examples that you could give us so we can get this in the right context?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think if you think back to last fall, and obviously there was an organization called the Conservative Action Council that was influential in one of the ballot questions, and that particular organization, association, did not file as a ballot question committee. They simply didn't ever admit that they were a ballot question committee. They would never admit that they actually raised or collected money from another source, although it didn't appear they had any source of funds other than raising or collecting for that ballot question committee. And so what this bill would do is for organizations like that is they would be required to file this this particular document, sign under penalty of perjury, when they make their contribution to the existing ballot question committee, saying, we did not raise or collect this from another source for this purpose. And so you're going to have to make an affirmative statement that you're not a ballot question committee, as opposed to now just completely ignoring and never talking to anybody.
Further questions, Representative Lust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Secretary of State. I would love to ask Senator Valley this, but I think it may be a little too technical. I don't want to put him on the spot. Secretary of State, if you could turn to page 2, I'm wondering if could you explain to me, actually page 2 and 3, the reasons for sub 1 and 2? And let me give you a little bit of context. I'm thinking if you just left in 3, sub 3, if neither of the above apply, a statement providing all that information, isn't that really what you want in the sub 3, and if that's the case, why have the requirements or the option of providing 1 and 2?
Thank you. I appreciate the question, if I might, Mr. Chairman. And again, this is existing requirement that's just been reworded. And the purpose here is so that when an organization makes a contribution to a ballot question committee, and I'm looking at the ballot question committee's report, and I see something called ABC Association, so that I have the ability to find out who is ABC Association. And they either need to be, one, filed as an entity with my office, or number two, filed as an entity in another jurisdiction, and tell us what jurisdiction are you in fact filed with, or if you're neither of those, then you fit into that third category. And in 2006, we had a couple that fell into this last category that they weren't filed anywhere. They were simply a made-up name, and we couldn't figure out, you know, who's associated with that particular name. And so as an organization given contributions, you're going to fall into one of those three categories, and it's simply for us to be able to find out, you know, who are you, where are you at?
Follow up. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And that really gets to the heart of the question. If I am an entity in good standing in South Dakota, all that you're going to do is sift through that filing, then cross-reference that entity and get the same information you're going to get in three. So why wouldn't it just make more sense that every time you're in an organization under this section, instead of having one and two, why don't you just have them provide the information you're requiring in sub three? Because you're going to probably sift through the good standing and all that to get to this information anyway.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, I think it's to try to keep this as simple as possible for the contributing entity so that they don't have to list all of that information that's found in three if it's already publicly filed either in my office or one of my counterparts' offices. Okay. It's to keep that as simple as possible.
One more. I understand your sensitivity to the organization. I'm looking at more from the consumer, if you will, trying to get the information. And to me, it almost seems to make a lot more sense just to have all the information the first time and have the entity have to provide it rather than have the consumer have to cross-reference and sort through. Would that make more sense from a consumer standpoint?
Mr. Chairman, yes. From a consumer standpoint, it would, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another question for the Secretary of State. Secretary, say somebody's not aware of this law, and maybe they're from outside the state, and you're sifting through these reports, and you see that ABC Corporation or companies contributed over $10,000, and it's after the fact. Would you just give them a warning and say send in the notification, or what will happen?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, when they make that contribution, they have to give this statement to the ballot question committee that they're giving the money to, and then that becomes part of the report that ballot question committee files with us. And so if we saw that contribution that wasn't accompanied by that statement, well, we would get back to that ballot question committee and say, hey, you're missing something here. You need to go get that information and file it in order to have a complete report. And let me just say, when organizations are dealing with this kind of money, this level, I don't think they're not going to know what the law is. They hire bright lawyers to try to understand what the law is when they're playing at that level.
Further questions? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and move into committee comment and or action. Representative Lust.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment.
What would it be?
I would. Starting on page 2, strike lines 21 through 24. Page 3, strike lines 1 through 4. And everything in line 5 up to the word A.
Does everyone understand the amendment?
A second.
Could you repeat it once more, Representative Lust?
Yeah, on page 2, striking everything on lines 21 through 24.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially sub 1, sub 2 are gone. And then on line 3, striking lines
page
1
three.
Through 4.
Page 3, correct.
Page 3, sorry. Mm-hmm. Lines 1 through 4. And then on line 5 of page 3, you would strike everything up to the A.
Any further questions on the proposed amendment? Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
With motion on the floor, moved by Representative Lust, second by Representative Turbeville. Any further comments, Representative Lust?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm trying to do is subs 1 and 2, you know, really don't provide a lot of help to the consumer, because if an entity or an organization is in good standing, all that does is the consumer then needs to go to the next portal in the Secretary website, sift through their good standing certificate, or if it's a good standing in another state, they'd have to cross-reference to another state's Secretary of State's website to really get all the information you're seeking, which is in sub 3. I think it'd be simpler, frankly, for the organization and for the consumer to simply say, to get the information you need, which is the name of the organization, the street address, the, you know, so on and so forth, as listed in sub 3. I think really that's the nub of the issue, and it's simpler just to say, hey, here's what you have to file if your organization contributing this amount of money to a ballot question committee. And so I think we might as well just cut through all the other stuff and get right to the pertinent information.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Ingalls.
I think the information that Representative Lust is seeking to delete could be some useful information, and particularly so if we have, say, a made-up organization that maybe some individuals just gonna say, well, this is my association, and I'm giving this money. I think if we have, if we leave the other information in here, it's easier to track that organization down. So I don't want to make it any harder for the Secretary of State than it needs to be, and I'd rather just leave this, leave it the way that it is.
Further comments or questions? Representative Lust.
Let me just rebut that. I mean, the information you're ultimately seeking, if you have the name of the organization, you can cross-reference the Secretary of State's website anyway. So whether they're in good standing or not is frankly immaterial to the consumer. They just want to know the information, who it is, who are the people involved, and that's all in sub 3. That may not be in your good standing certificate in certain states. So I think it makes more sense to just strip away everything, get to the issue, which is what's the name of this thing, who's participating, who's the contribution coming from, and that's all in sub 3. If you're allowed to use sub 1 and 2, that information in 3 you may never know if you're a consumer. And I think that's the important information.
Further comments or questions? Representative Feinstein.
I guess my comment on this amendment, when I just look at number 3, if we have an LLC or another type of organization, I wonder if that is left out if we delete those portions that Representative Lust is attempting to delete. And I guess in that case, if that is the case, we'd probably have to further amend the lines 5 through 10 to allow for LLCs and other types of entities, and I think it's covered otherwise. So that's my reasoning for possibly leaving it in. And I'd be open to a comment from Representative Lust, because I know we both work in those areas.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lust.
If I could ask Secretary of State Nelson a question, it'll be brief. Secretary of State Nelson, is organization defined somewhere in these?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, yes. In 1227.1, we have a number of definitions, including a definition for organization, which includes corporations, LLCs, associations, any type of entity like that.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could, I don't want to amend this on the fly without, I would like your thoughts on the proposed amendment.
Thank you. If I might, I think that the concern that I would have with the amendment, if we look on page 3, lines 9 and 10, that's some additional information then that would be required from every one of these contributors. And let's say you've got a large publicly held corporation that's making a contribution. Now all of a sudden, instead of just listing either I'm in good standing in South Dakota or good standing in some other state, all of a sudden they're going to have to list every one of their owners on this statement. And to me, that would become very, very burdensome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Seeing none, the motion before us is a Lust motion to amend. This is a voice vote. All in favor of the motion will signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No.
No.
Motion fails. With that, we'll go back to the original bill. Are there any further committee comments and or action? Representative Feinstein.
I'll move to pass on SB 180.
Motion by Feinstein, second by Boomgarten. Do pass on Senate Bill 180. Further comments, Representative Feinstein?
No, I believe it's been covered very well, and I urge your passage of this bill.
Any further comments? Seeing none, the motion before us is do pass on Senate Bill 180. All in favor of the motion will vote aye. All opposed will vote no. The Secretary will please call the roll.
Representatives Boomgarden.
Aye.
Ingalls.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gosch.
Aye.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lucas.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Rausch.
Aye.
Rave.
Aye.
Steele.
Aye.
Turberville.
Aye.
Noem.
Aye.
Fain.
Aye.
The vote is unanimous.
Senate Bill 180 will be sent to the House floor with the do pass recommendation. Thank you, Senator. Thanks, Senator Hansen. You made him wait. With that, we'll move to the top of today's committee agenda and take up Senate Joint Resolution 3, proposing and submitting to the electors at the next general election an amendment to Article 3, Section 6 of the Constitution of the State of South Dakota relating to four-year senatorial terms and term limits. Are there any proponents for SJR 3? Good morning, Senator Hansen, and thank you for allowing us to
Good
jump
morning.
The calendar.
Good morning. No problem. Tom Hansen, Senator from District 22, representing Beetlehand and Girald County. And I will introduce the issue and briefly, and then my co-sponsor can kind of take over and fill in from there. But the way this all came about is, I think that the public is more involved in good government than what we sometimes recognize, and I have a group of people that I have coffee with on a pretty regular basis, and they start out by saying, why is it that senators only have two-year terms? Well, the first answer is we do it that way because that's the way we've always done it. But it is a question, I think, that is worthy of some debate. And I said, I explained how it's in the Constitution, and if you want to change the Constitution, why there's a procedure that you follow to accomplish that. And of course, one thing led to another, and this issue has been brought up various times in recent years, and been put to the voters on all those instances, and has never been able to achieve the success that wasn't intended. But that doesn't mean that it's not worthy of continued debate. And you'll notice there's only two sponsors on the bill. We did not do any great amount of lobbying or arm twisting and trying to convince people that this way or that way is the best way to go, because I think that if we're going to bring something to the ballot, it first of all needs to come from kind of a uniform voice as far as the legislative body is concerned. And I recognize that the way the bill was written to begin with probably would be changed, as you'll notice it already has been. There was an amendment put on when it went through the Senate. And but I think now it's your turn to have a hand in molding it. And if you can get it molded good enough so that it's acceptable to the House of Representatives and to the Senate, why it will go to the vote of the people. It is a fairly complex issue. And as we look into it, I'm aware that North Dakota has a somewhat similar situation. They have four-year terms for their senators and four-year terms for their members of the House of Representatives. The thing that's different in North Dakota is that they alternate. Half of the districts are up for election in every two-year cycle. And that was a goal that I thought was very worthwhile, to avoid this possibility that all 105 of our legislative members could turn over in any one election. The probability of that's about zero, but theoretically it's possible. But the things that that you don't think about is the difficulty of working around redistricting every 10 years, and to try to have it so that at the end of the term that a person is serving, that they're not all of a sudden going to find themselves redistricted into two legislators being from the same district. And so there are problems. But I think with that, I'll turn it over to my co-sponsor. In fact, he has an amendment that I think actually makes a lot of sense, that that still doesn't give us any assurance that it will wear well with the public. But again, these are issues that I think are very worth the time and spending some debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Further proponents?
Mr. Chair, Mark Feinstein, representative from District 14. I think as Senator Hansen has alluded, when we started this, we've been tag-teaming it all the way, and which is why I was sitting here with him, and he's here to answer questions on the other side. When it was first proposed, the bill just said 4-year terms for state senate. And I said I'd be happy to sign on, but I'm getting pressure when I walk the streets campaigning, not only, okay, to say the personal interest, my spouse is saying, why do we have to run every 2 years? That's ridiculous, especially when you're termed out in 8 years. And people just all over said, we have to put out money, we have to, we enjoy seeing you, but it's just too much every 2 years. So I said, Tom, I would sign on to it if we put it into 4-year terms for the House also, because I think it only makes sense. And that was, how we decided to go forward and realize there were lots of amendments that had to be necessary to get us to where we are. The next thing I did is I started looking at staggered terms. I thought that was a great idea. But then all of a sudden, you have redistricting every 10 years, as Senator Hansen was saying. And you could just imagine if you had 4-year terms, one set of 10 years, somebody would be in office for 8 years. The next set, they'd be in for 12 years. The next set, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, we went to a 12-year term on it to cover that. But then we realized there were other messes because, again, redistricting, if we staggered the term, you could just imagine the mess it is. And one of the amendment I have before you essentially is 2-year term, I'm sorry, 4-year terms for House and Senate. Everybody is elected at the same time. We have a 4-year term, a 4-year term, and a 2-year term. 4 years, 4 years, two, and on and on and on. And that takes care of the redistricting issue. It was something that I was thinking about the whole time. How are we going to get around that? When I started sketching it out, it just didn't make sense to go 4-4-4-4 and on and on. Then when Senator Hansen and I were talking, he made some contact with the North Dakota folks, and that's that handout that you have there. And as you can see, if you go to, the bottom of the first page and go over to, I believe it's the third page, you can sort of see the mess that they are in because of this. I mean, I believe a lot of us know, Representative Koppelman? From North Dakota, and he's been in quite a while up there. They don't have term limits, but nothing against him, but he couldn't even figure out how they did it. And it's if you read through this, you'll see why 442 actually works. And it's just a real mess up there. And my understanding is they're going to be starting their third after the third census, and they still don't have the problems ironed out. The problems are still, my understanding, probably still in front of the court because of the issues that go on with 4-year terms straight. There's been some editorials, and I think we all got some emails from term limit folks and say, well, geez, why are we doing this? Especially after the South Dakota voters elected not to do away with term limits. Well, this does not do away with term limits. It still holds on to term limits. So we're not changing the will of the voters at all. We're actually making what Senator Hansen and I feel is a lot more sense of trying to run state government and move ourselves forward. Another reason why House members, I believe, also have to be 4-year terms versus 2-year terms. As you can imagine, if House members were 2 years and they had 10-year limits, you can imagine in the middle of a cycle, the senator in your district could have another 2 years to go on the term, and the House member might be out. You know, if we're trying to keep some form of continuity, it only makes sense to have all the terms congruent, and the 4-year terms, I believe, 4, 4, and 2, I believe makes a lot of sense.
Thank you, sir. Are there any further proponents?
Any further proponents for SJR 3? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Any opponents to Senate Joint Resolution 3? Seeing none, we'll waive rebuttal and move to committee questions. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd ask a question to Senator Hansen. So, Senator, if I understand your comments correctly and agreeing essentially with the amendment that we've been offered, you're willing to forego your original argument that everybody in the legislature could be reelected as a compromise to for the four-year terms twice and the two-year term then the following.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, yes, you're absolutely right. My intent in bringing this forward was to start a discussion, to start a dialogue, and recognizing that, and that's why I said I didn't want to go out and try to pile up a great big list of co-sponsors. The more I think about the amendment that Representative Feinstein has brought forward, it answers an awful lot of things, and it's not as complicated as what it might would appear. I guess the big thing is how willing are all the participants, the legislators as well as the public, to accept 4 years in some terms and 2 years in some others. But the way it's going to work out is that redistricting takes place with the 2010 census. The first election that will become effective will be the 2012 for seating in the 2013 legislative body. And in my case, I will be termed out so that I would not be eligible to run again in 2012. Those who have one more term left, though, those that would not be termed out until the following cycle, they could then take advantage of what's doing is stretching, the eight-year term out to 10-year potential. And there was no one that would be unjustly dealt with as a result of the going to 4-4 and 2. There are some that would be able to, that are in the legislative body right now. Those that are in their first term, those that are in their second term, they could end up serving 10 years rather than 8. And I think that also is good government. It's a good compromise, and I would encourage you to support the amendment.
Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a follow-up for Representative Feinstein. With amendment, then, J3OB, if we're going to have everybody in sync, then would we have to delete the restriction or the words that apply for partial terms that person may be appointed to? However, this restriction does not apply to partial terms, because then somebody's appointed partially to a four-year term, then they could come back and say, I could run for 2 4-year terms and a 2-year term. Would you agree that maybe that needs to go as well?
We tried to think of a lot of things here, and I guess that's one thing I did not think about, but I think I wouldn't speak for Senator Hansen, but I probably suggested that I think we'd be open to that. And I don't know how to address that right here. It hits me a little cold, so I don't know if. I don't know exactly what we would do to that.
Further questions? Seeing none, we will close to committee comment and or action. Any comment or action from the committee? Representative Noem.
Mr. Chair, I would move amendment J3OB.
Second.
Motion by Noem, second by Rave, to move amendment J3OB. Further comments? Representative Noem.
No, I like the amendment. I like it fixes some of the issues that I had with the bill. When I looked back at my personal situation, I know that in trying to consider to run for the House versus the Senate, I think we would have a situation where it would become a more desirable run to run for the Senate and therefore leave possibly open seats in the House, so with a lot of competition and primaries being created over there as well. So I like the equality of this. I like that we've addressed the redistricting, and I'd ask you to support the motion.
Further comments? Representative Roush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would, I guess, ask the committee to resist the motion. To go to 4-4-2 because we're afraid that a redistricting is going to have you have a different race, to me, is a very weak argument. The fact that a two-year term in the House, we have that at the federal level. I would think if it was such a good deal that we'd have gone to 4 years a long time ago on the federal level. I think the people have a right to elect somebody to come out here every 2 years. As one that has to run every 2 years, like we all do, I would much prefer a four-year term, but I think that does an injustice to the people sending us out here. I would ask that you resist the motion. I like the bill to go to 6 2-year terms in the House and 3 4-year terms in the Senate. And if you're in the Senate, that would be one of the risks, although I think it would be very small that you would run up against a census problem. So I would ask that you resist the motion and pass the bill. Thank you.
Further comments? Representative Feinstein.
Mr. Chair, I guess I urge passage of this for obvious reasons as a sponsor of the amendment and the bill. I think what we have is a difference between the U.S. House of Representatives and the South Dakota State House of Representatives is federally there are no term limits. And I think the purpose of being close to the people is, you know, in a sense, your term limited every 2 years, because the people have spoken loud and clear to give us term limits right now of 8 years. Extending to 10 isn't that big of a difference, but we are term limited at that point. And I just think, as I explained out there in when I was testifying, if we have three four-year terms, we really do run into a mess with redistricting. And when you put pencil it out and put it on paper, you see again one set of 10 years, you're going to have 2 8-year terms. The next set of 10 years, you're going to have 3 12-year terms in that particular legislative district. And it just, you know, a lot of thought went into it, and that was the result. The amendment was the ultimate result. The final version of this was reviewed by the Secretary of State. I don't want to speak for him, but he did not mind the amendment. I'll say that. So I urge its passage.
Further comments? Seeing none, the motion before us is J3OB to amend to Senate Joint Resolution 3. This is a voice vote. All in favor of the amendment will signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
The chair is in doubt. We will ask for a roll call vote, please. This will be a roll call vote. All in favor of the amendment will vote aye. All opposed will vote no. Secretary will please call the roll.
Representative Boomgarten.
No.
Ingalls.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gosch.
No.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lucas.
Aye.
Lust.
No.
Roush.
No.
Rave.
Aye.
Steele.
Aye.
Turberville.
Aye.
Nome.
Aye.
Fain.
No.
Mr. Chairman, there are 8 yes, 5 no.
Senate Joint Resolution 3 will be amended as noted. With that, any further comments or action on Senate Joint Resolution 3? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would offer a further amendment that would be on page 2, line 5, to delete the sentence starting with, however, this restriction does not apply to partial terms to which a legislator may be appointed.
Does he have a second?
Second.
Motion by Lucas, second by Noam. For further amendment, any further comments, Representative Lucas?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, simply, however you feel about, you know, the pending amendment and bill, the bill as amended, I guess, in order to make it work, I think that that sentence would have to be removed. Otherwise, you would run into a situation where you'd have legislators elected that wouldn't be in the proper two-year sync.
Further comments? Representative Feinstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When I was up there, I didn't think quick enough on this particular amendment. I guess as I look at the partial restrictions, and I was thinking in different terms as my good friend from Mission, I think because the years are stated when we're elected for a four-year term and when we're elected for a two-year term in the bill, I don't know if that argument applies. And so I don't believe the amendment's necessary. I believe what it does do is, yes, it could. Somebody could end up with about a 13-year term, I suppose, and that would be probably the extent of it. But right now, when somebody is elected or appointed for a partial term, they can serve up to 10 years, the way the current law is. I just think that's one of the vagaries of the system. I think it happens. And I don't think it's a real prevalent issue and a problem that really needs to be adjusted out here. I don't think it's necessary.
Further comments on the proposed amendment? Seeing none, this as well is a voice vote. All in favor of the amendment will signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no.
No.
Motion fails. Any further comment or action on Senate Joint Resolution 3? Further comment and or action?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Noem.
I'd move do pass.
Motion by Noem, second by Feinstein. Do pass on Senate Joint Resolution 3 as amended. Further comments? Representative Noem?
Nope.
Any further comments?
I would ask, Mr. Chair.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would urge the committee to resist this. I like the bill in its original form, although I think that the citizens of South Dakota are going to get a little bit tired of us coming at them on this issue repeatedly and repeatedly. I'm a huge proponent of term limits and have advocated for them in numerous forums, and I've always qualified that by saying I think they should be 12 years. But, frankly, we've had this issue on the ballot so many times. And I think people get a little frustrated with the sense, and maybe just be a perception of the self-serving nature of these, of resolutions of this kind. And therefore, I just think it's not well-timed, maybe in a next election cycle, but I think we all know where this will go at this time. It'll be strongly opposed, and it will not be strongly supported, certainly financially. And I think it's a futile effort to put the electorate through this procedure again at this time. Thank you.
Further comments? Representative Noem.
Well, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I think that it was good discussion to have. I think we've had this on our ballot before, but not necessarily in this format. Every 2 years when we come around for election time, I'm amazed at how much things cost and how much money gets spent on campaigns and to go back and do that every single year. Many times, I'm sure we've all asked ourselves at different times, what's the best way to spend people's money, having that election every other year. I think it's good discussion. I haven't seen this particularly lately come to the people of South Dakota in this format, and I'd ask that you would support the motion.
For the comments, Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Well, my issue on this, I guess I always ask, is does this make the legislature stronger or weaker in relationship to the executive branch of government? And I believe it would. Obviously, nobody was here to testify against this. And if we were successful in passing this today and on the House floor later this week or next week, it would go to the vote of the people. And if there are groups out there that wanted to advocate against this, it would be much simpler to be here today or email us, which I've only received maybe one or two, to defeat this measure, because once it goes on the ballot, then it's going to cost considerably more money if you're opposed to it. So I think it will make the legislature stronger, more effective, and for that reason, I'm supporting it.
Further comments? Representative Hunhoff.
Well, I'll admit I'm conflicted on it also. I think I will support the motion. I think it's something the legislature, the full legislature, might enjoy debating, quite frankly. But I have to agree with Representative Lust. I think the public would vote for one-year term limits if they could. And they'd tighten them up just as much as they could. And I also have some concern about four-year term limits in a citizen legislature. I just feel that, let's face it, we have many, many senior citizen legislators. We have many legislators who are very busy and trying to earn a living back home, and a four-year commitment maybe is just further out there than a lot of them can really commit, quite frankly, and it might end up in a lot more appointments, retirements, early retirements and appointments, which has never been good for my party historically. So I think on a lot of different levels it's a problem, and it's probably a waste of time, because I do think the public will resoundingly vote no on it, but I think the full legislature should weigh in, so I'll support the motion.
Further comments? Seeing none, the motion before us is a do pass on Senate Joint Resolution 3 as amended. This is a roll call vote. All in favor of the motion will say aye. All opposed will say no. The Secretary will please call the roll.
Representatives Boomgarden.
Nay.
Ingalls.
Pass.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gosch.
No.
Hunhoff.
Aye.
Lucas.
Aye.
Lust.
No.
Rausch.
No.
Rave. Steele.
Aye.
Turberville.
No.
Nome.
Aye.
Fain.
Aye.
Ingalls.
No.
Mr. Chairman, we have 7 yes and 6 no.
Senate Joint Resolution 3 as amended will go to the House floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you, sir. Is there a someone would consider moving the title amendment?
So moved. Second.
Moved by Turberville, second by Rave for title amendment to SJR 3. The title amendment would delete senatorial and insert legislative. Any comments on that motion? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. With that, we will take a proponent testimony on Senate Bill 5 to revise the form and style of certain provisions and to delete certain obsolete provisions regarding the Department of Tourism and State Development. Are there any proponents for Senate Bill 5? Good morning.
Okay, is this better? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I was intending, I guess, to allow Senator Gant to speak first, but not seeing him, I will go ahead and step forward. Kim Olson, Deputy Secretary for the Department of Tourism and State Development, and this bill is a result of the Sunset Review study that our department underwent this summer. I think that study was actually a very helpful study for us internally, as well as hopefully for the legislators that were members of that committee. For us, it really gave us an opportunity to interact with the citizens. There were several public hearings in several different communities, and it also gave us an opportunity, I believe, to discuss some of the functions that our offices has and ways to improve them. This bill specifically isn't, though, dealing with any of those things. This bill was brought forward by that group as the intention of just being a style and form changes, deletion and obsolete statutes, and transfers of code that didn't get transferred when our department was reorganized by the governor in 2003. So I'll give you a little bit overview of that. It gets a little technical, but I'll just give you a high-level overview of the sections that are being changes. Specifically, there are 7 areas that are being changed in this legislation beyond just style and form changes. Again, none of those are substantive or altering any content, but I will give you an overview of those. In Section 2, a South Dakota Codified Law 1-4-4 gets moved to Chapter 1-52, which is the Tourism and State Development Chapter. This is a statute that did not get moved with the reorganization. In Section 19, South Dakota Codified Law 1-16G-19 is a statute that is obsolete and inconsistent with our current Codified Law 1-16G-5. This is a section that discusses our Ready Loan Program, and there have been modifications made to this program, but this statute wasn't ever updated and wasn't deleted, and it should have been. Section 21 is referred to South Dakota Codified Law 1-16H-7, and it is regarding the South Dakota Science and Technology Authority. When they passed that law, they incorrectly inserted the Bureau of Personnel instead of the Board of Finance, and so that makes that change. Section 70 refers to South Dakota Codified Law 1-19B, and this is style and form change only, but it's related to the local historic preservation statutes. Sections 123 through 125 changes the language from the Governor's Office of Economic Development to formerly the Department of Tourism and State Development. Sections 126, 127, and 130 repeal three sections of law because the sites have been abolished. And then sections 120 and 129 transfer six tourism sites to now again Chapter 1-52, which is again the chapter for the Department of Tourism and State Development. These are also chapters that are statutes that did not get moved under the reorganization. So that's a brief explanation of what's going on in, I guess, a very big bill. And with that, I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. Is there any further proponents for Senate Bill 5?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Johnson. I'm with Absolutely Aberdeen. We had the good fortune of participating in all of the Department of Tourism and State Development Agency review meetings this summer, including the good fortune of hosting one in our area. Thank you to those of you on this committee who served in that capacity. This is an area of the law that I have followed for more than the last 20 years. And I have also gone through this bill with a fine-tooth comb to be sure that it doesn't dangerously tinker with any of the current state's economic development tools. I think we can tell you in all good faith that it doesn't make any substantive changes to any of the state's economic development tools, and it is deserving of your passage. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents for Senate Bill 5? Further proponents for Senate Bill 5? Are there any opponents to Senate Bill 5? Any opponents? Seeing none, we'll waive the rebuttal and open it up for committee questions. No questions of the committee? All right, we will close to committee questions and open it up for committee discussion and or action. Representative Rausch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move due pass on Senate Bill 5.
The motion before us is a due pass motion of Senate Bill 5 moved by Representative Rausch, seconded by Gosch. Is there any comments to that motion?
It just looks to me like a lot of good effort and the changes that are necessary. Thank you.
Further comments? Okay, the motion before the committee is a due pass motion on Senate Bill 5. Secretary will call the vote. Those in favor vote aye. Those opposed nay. The Secretary will call the vote.
Representative Boomgarden.
Aye.
Ingalls.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gosch.
Aye.
Hunhoff. Lucas.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Rausch.
Aye.
Rave. Steele. Turberville. Noam. Fain. Madam Chair, we have 10 yes, 3 excused.
Senate Bill 5 moves to the House floor with a due pass motion.
Second.
Motion is made for consent. All those in favor will vote aye.
Aye.
Those opposed nay. Senate Bill 5 will be put on the consent calendar. Thank you. With that, we will close testimony on Senate Bill 5. We will open up testimony on Senate Bill 141. 141, establish certain requirements regarding the siting of certain wind turbine towers. Is there any proponents to Senate Bill 141?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senator Dan Ollers, District 25. Senate Bill 141 will enact, if passed, a siting requirements for certain types of wind turbines. This fall, many of us attended a PUC meeting that talked about the different challenges with respect to wind turbine and wind energy generation in South Dakota. Many of you received this packet, and the piece of paper that's being handed out to you right now is the model ordinance from the PUC for wind energy systems. Now, I believe that most of these ordinances should be at the local level, particularly the county. But in the case of the distance and with respect to property lines and the distance between turbines, I believe this should be a statewide ordinance. The reason for this is because property lines do not know county boundaries. And the science behind this, you can't negotiate. It's the 1.1 times the height of the turbine or 500 feet, whichever is greater. And for that purpose, I believe that this should be a state ordinance. We have done something very similar here recently with a bill that we passed for counties that do not have building code ordinances. We just passed the legislation to enact the International Building Code for 2006. This falls under that same principle because just because the model legislation is out there doesn't mean that all counties will adopt it. On your handout, the highlighted sections are what you will find in the bill. The first section and second section deal with identifying the small wind energy systems versus the large, and then section 3 talks about the setback, which is outlined in your model wind ordinance overview, along with the option for landowners to have an agreement if one adjacent landowner should enter an agreement with another to allow that wind turbine to be closer to the property line. And this is, you know, which brings me to my second point. This is a property rights issue also. This will protect landowners and their investments with wind energy. The best example I can think in that goes on currently is with our state billboards and our highway system. You have to have 600 feet between each billboard. Well, if my adjacent landowner decided to park that billboard right next to the property line, and I don't have 600 feet of frontage along that interstate, then I cannot put a billboard up. That person effectively eliminates the option for me. This bill would protect this with respect to wind turbines because they would have to have the setback so far from the property line so that both landowners would be able to benefit from that process. I will stand by for any questions you may have and appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any further proponents? Any further proponents of Senate Bill 141? Seeing none, are there any opponents? Any opponents to Senate Bill 141? Seeing none, we'll waive rebuttal and move to committee questions. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the opponent. I have a question for Senator Ollers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ollers, can you explain for me the problem that currently exists that requires this solution?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative Lust. Right now, we have no ordinances with respect to the siting of wind turbines. We're trying to be proactive or preemptive with this in order to avoid any problems there might be in the future. Because we do not have a lot of wind development in this state at this time, it's kind of a necessary evil just to make sure that your property rights are protected as we move forward. Typically, with the larger companies, they already abide by this, but you know there are many different companies out there. There are also individuals that may stand to benefit or take on this project by themselves. It's for those that it's for those few that might tend to abuse this or not follow the science, I guess, behind the sightings more than the companies, than the majority. You always make the laws for those few that might break the law, not those that abide by it, I guess.
Follow-up?
Representative Les.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you, Senator Ellis, could you explain to me why the distinction between small wind energy systems and large wind energy systems hinges on height of the tower rather than on the kilovolts or kilowatts carried by the electrical lines?
Mr. Chair, thanks for the question, Representative Lust. Your ability to generate the amount of energy that one generates is dictated by the size. The larger the turbine, the more energy, the larger the generator, the more capacity. That's true at this time. That could change with science in the future, but basically the size of the turbine will dictate its output.
Senator Ellers, just so I'm clear on it, is this a proposed law to avoid problems with towers tipping, or is this more designed for, if you'd say, privacy and noise issues? What are we trying to avoid here?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. The distance between towers is in order for them to work properly. As the wind passes through a turbine, the air moves around it, and before it returns to its normal flow, you have to have that proper distance in between those turbines. Now, as far as noise, those are addressed also in the model ordinance provided by the PUC, but I believe that those are local issues and can be addressed there. That becomes a matter of preference. To your counties and local governments. I think the real concern here with this legislation was to make sure that there was proper distance between those for them to work effectively.
So your main concern is so my wind turbine doesn't interfere with the efficiency of yours?
That is the second component to this legislation is property rights, yes.
Good, thank you. Representative Rausch.
Question for Senator Ahlers. In Minnesota, right across the border from where our big wind development is in South Dakota, what have they done? Do they have presently this type of ordinance, or have they not noticed a problem, and are we trying to solve a problem that doesn't and quite possibly won't exist?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Representative Rausch. I do believe that Minnesota does have some ordinances. I did not investigate what they have. Typically, it's not good to come to the South Dakota legislature and say, well, Minnesota does this, because that never holds a lot of water here. But they do have some siting ordinances. To the particulars of that, I cannot answer.
Further questions? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ellis, I just want to clarify on the follow-up on Representative Fain's question regarding why the distance, and I believe your response was to allow the efficiency of the system to work. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative Lust, that is correct. There has to be a set distance between the turbines in order for them to work effectively, and then Representative Fain's other part of the question had to do with the property rights issue to allow adjacent landowners to both benefit from being able to have wind turbines on their property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused by the first portion of your response. I don't see anything in this bill that talks about any distance vis-a-vis another tower or another turbine. I see it only in reference to property lines.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. In Section 3, it does refer to the property line. In this case, that's the most crucial element of it, of this, is to allow both property owners to benefit from that wind energy. It's not necessary to have the siding when it's on the property, because the company that typically sets it up will abide by that standard, because they're making a great investment. They're going to set it up correctly to make sure that it works. This part of the bill is in here for property rights.
Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and move to committee comment and or action. Any committee comment and or action? Representative Engels, I'm sorry I didn't see you.
I'll play. Do pass.
Motion by Engels, second by Feinstein for do pass on Senate Bill 141. Further comments, Representative Engels? Any further comments? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe to clear up some confusion that regarding investment in a wind farm, the standard is, according to the science, is that ideally wind turbines should be spaced 8 to 10 rotor diameters apart in the direction of the prevailing wind, and 5 rotor diameters apart in a direction perpendicular to the prevailing wind. So if you look at those wind farms that you see, not only in South Dakota but in other states, they're not lined up all in a straight row. So they're spaced out to capture the wind energy as efficiently as possible. And if somebody stacked up their wind farm right next to somebody else's property, it would be at a disadvantage for the other person if they wanted to put a wind farm in right next to them.
Further comments? Representative Lust.
Well, I'm going to ask that you resist a motion, do pass. I think this represents another example of an overly aggressive approach on the state level. I think counties well within their ability to regulate these things, and it frankly has been their historical purview, not state. This reeks to me a little bit almost of statewide zoning, which I'm not sure many of us would favor. And furthermore, I think the concerns here about these towers in relation to property lines probably is covered by common law trespass in the event these things fall onto another property line. And I'm sure the practice in the industry is to not, where possible, locate them right next to a property line. So I didn't hear anything that requires this to be done right now. I didn't hear anything that requires this to be done on a statewide basis. And I didn't hear any compelling reason why this can't be done by individual counties. So for those reasons, I would ask that you resist the motion to pass. Thank you.
Further comments? Representative Lucas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, simply, if you could visualize this, about the spacing of the wind turbines from, based upon the size of the blades, they're recommending that it would be 59 acres per wind turbine. So you're talking of a 60-acre section for one turbine. That's where the problem is, not from falling over another person's or individual's property rights, but from taking their air away from them, where they may want to have wind farm on the other side. It's kind of like, we used to have these water rights. The person upstream would be able to control the water rights, and then years ago they used to have fights over who had the water rights. Now, nowadays there's been some fights over oil rights. In fact, the first Gulf War started when Kuwait, they drilled directionally underneath Iraq to take their oil from them, and then Iraq invaded Kuwait, and we went over and aided Kuwait because we thought Iraq was an aggressor there. But that was the underlying principle. That I think this would just prevent one person from going after another one because they think that they've taken away their prevailing wind or their opportunity to put a wind farm up because somebody's already got the wind turbines put up right in the spaces that they want to put them in.
For the comments, Representative Hunhoff.
Mr. Chairman, well, I'm not sure this is being overly aggressive. I think it's just being proactive in trying to work with a new industry that we're facing, and we welcome the new industry. But it reminds me of when we were faced in the 1990s with the confined animal feeding units. Really, there was a wave of them coming across the state, and it looked like there could be some good economic development there, but the counties clearly weren't ready for the zoning, and the legislature just laid out some basics as the counties got caught up with the industry, and it seems to me very much the same thing. And this is a very soft glove approach, it seems to me. I think along with the effort to set a setback from turbine to turbine, it also does setback. It also creates a very reasonable setback for property rights in general. I mean, I don't think there are many safety issues with the turbines, but it does create a reasonable setback for that and for visual appeal, for aesthetics, and for other reasons as well. So I think it in just a very mild way, does establish some kind of a zoning. You have to remember also in South Dakota, we have such a myriad of zoning all across our state. Some counties, I'm not sure, are even zoned yet, and others zoned in all different ways. So this is a very easy approach to an emerging industry, I think.
Further comments? Seeing none, the motion before us is due pass on Senate Bill 141. This is a roll call vote. All in favor of the motion will signify by saying aye. All opposed will say no. The Secretary will please call the roll.
Representatives Boomgarden.
Nay.
Ingalls.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gosch.
Aye.
Hunhoff. Lucas.
Aye.
Lust.
No.
Rausch.
No.
Rave.
Aye.
Steele.
Aye.
Turberville.
Aye.
Nome. Fain.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, we have 10 yes, 3 no.
Senate Bill 141 will be sent to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Seeing no further business, is there anything else to come before this committee? Seeing none, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. Motion by Turberville, second by Rausch. Any comment? All in favor of motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We are adjourned.